You're listening to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, recording in Washington, D.C.
And I'm your co-host, Catherine Putz, also known as Katie Putz, also in Washington, D.C.
Hello, Katie. How's it going?
Doing all right, I guess.
Yeah, I feel like we've all been potentially better these days, but still a lot to talk about. So, natural topic that we haven't yet gotten around to on our tour de force of the second Trump administration so far on this podcast, which I'll say it again, remains the biggest story in global geopolitics and in Asian geopolitics. So today we're here to talk about the trade war. April began with Liberation Day. I guess it didn't really begin with Liberation Day. They changed it to April 2nd to not have it fall on April Fool's Day. Liberation Day certainly liberated a lot of people from the value of their investment accounts and their expectations for broader economic growth in the United States and globally. So yes, I mean, for anybody following the markets, it's been a roller coaster of a month. We've had tariffs, we've had tariffs pause, we've had reciprocal tariffs, although does reciprocal actually describe what these tariffs are? But there's a lot to kind of dig into. There's obviously, I think, a very interesting conversation to be had about the longer term reset of expectations across Asia. There's been some interesting commentary about how this might begin to shift potential geopolitics in Northeast Asia, where Japan and South Korea, for instance, as U.S. allies, now have to make some interesting choices about whether they will seek to more deeply integrate themselves with China out of an interest in ensuring that their economies can adapt to a longer-term environment where the United States does maintain this more protectionist turn. Similarly, a lot of the targets of Trump's reciprocal tariffs included countries in the region in Southeast Asia, countries like Vietnam, countries like India. All of these states have, of course, taken it upon themselves to try and negotiate with the United States to get the tariffs either reduced or removed. And meanwhile, you have essentially financial meltdown in the United States. And there's a debate still underway about just how much that is likely to moderate the Trump administration. I'll just say here, Katie, before I turn it to you, I think we saw more evidence in the first Trump administration that Donald Trump was sensitive to essentially what the market indices said, that if the index was high, he thought that was a referendum on his popularity, essentially. I think something's changed this time around. He doesn't quite take the Dow Jones or the S&P 500 performance as a referendum on his popularity. I think I saw it reported, I think it was in the New York Times a few weeks ago, that Trump apparently has told people close to him that if the market mattered, then Joe Biden would still be president because he oversaw the strongest stock market in American history, or at least the highest numbers on the indices. And he's not president, therefore the market must not matter. So I think that's sent some disconcerting signals to investors who now, I think, are unconvinced by Trump's willingness to potentially moderate, that Trump is deeply ideologically committed to basically the one idea that he's consistently held on to for 40 plus years, which is that tariffs are the solution to all of life's problems, from fentanyl to unfair treatment by China, and whatever else have you. So yeah, that's kind of my initial opening rant. Katie, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's been a bit of a roller coaster, and I think your point on what the market is doing and what investors are thinking, I think markets and investors in the old days used to think there was some kind of strategy. And so if there were tariffs, then there was a reason. There doesn't seem to be really a coherent strategy. And I think for foreign partners, certainly the United States' Asian allies are trying to maneuver in different ways and have different capabilities to do so. So, for example, this week, we're recording on April 18th. This week, the Japanese Economic Revitalization Minister, Akazawa, was in D.C. for talks. I don't think that yielded anything. And when he returned to Tokyo, you know, he said, this is a quote, "I said what must be said from the Japanese side, including that the U.S. tariff measures are deeply regrettable and that we strongly seek a review of the series of measures." For listeners, Japan Has been targeted by a number of these tariffs. There are tariffs on cars in particular and car parts that are pretty significant for Japan's trade with the United States. But also in that sort of list of reciprocal, and I'm using scare quotes for reciprocal because that's not at all what these are and not what that word means. That they were hit with 23% in addition to these other things. And I think just to add my own little rant on the abuse of the English language, you know, when you say reciprocal tariff, an economist would tell you that that's you do this tariff to me, I will do that tariff right back to you. Reciprocal. It has a definition. The formula the administration used, and they released, you know, this full explanation from the USTR with this, you know, formula that had Greek letters in it, I think, to sort of confuse people. And economists looked at it and said, yeah, you're talking about trade deficits. You're not actually looking at tariffs or other sort of barriers to trade. You're like, there's no consideration of policies. It was a basic math, a mathing. I'm great with the English language. It was basic math on you know, a trade deficit. And trade deficits exist for a number of reasons. For example, we don't grow pineapples very much in the United States, and so we import them. The country that imports them to us. Anyway, I'm getting down this rabbit hole because it just is deeply confusing for anyone who's studied economics. One point I do want to also bring out is that, so, you know, Japan is trying to negotiate over this. All of these other countries are trying to either negotiate or find their way through. Kazakhstan is an interesting example. Kazakhstan was also on the reciprocal tariff list at 27%. It was the only Central Asian country on that list. But most of what Kazakhstan trades with the United States is energy, and that is exempted from these tariffs. So the numbers don't really even mean anything. And I think one thing I'm curious to hear your thoughts on, Ankit, is, you know, where do you think this is going to go? You know, do you think countries like Japan are going to find success in negotiating, or is that just going to sort of prove the concept of economic coercion?
Yeah, so that's I mean, in a way, the trillion-dollar question, I suppose, right? If you have the ability to predict Trump's policies regarding tariffs, you can potentially make a lot of money, right? Because he's been waffling, right? There was the pause. There's been exemptions for specific categories of goods, and the market's kind of swung up and down based on how these interventions are sort of carried out. So I think you got at something really important when you were talking about the formula, right? Which is that this is about trade deficits. And so what are the tariffs for? Like, Trump has this theory of tariffs in that other countries take advantage of the United States because the United States buys more things from them than they buy from the United States, right? That is what a trade deficit is. The US, like, one of the reasons, like, Vietnam, for instance, shows up so high on the list of reciprocal tariff countries because the U.S. imports a lot from Vietnam. So Vietnam got a 46% rate slapped on them. So the trade deficit problem is not going to get solved by this because tariffs ultimately, like, American consumer demand is going to remain strong as long as the American economy doesn't completely crater, which could happen. And then you have, like, economic demand destruction, essentially, where consumers just no longer have the appetite to buy cheap goods from Asia. There's implementation problems with the tariffs, right? There's already evidence that the tariffs just aren't being collected at American ports because the American customs system was not designed for this kind of global tariff or self-embargo system, essentially. The other piece of this is bringing manufacturing and reindustrializing the United States. And this is where arguably the administration's theory of tariffs runs into, I think, the greatest problems. So first of all, let's say you and I accept that that's a worthwhile goal, bringing manufacturing jobs back to America. There's essentially one really important input you need from that, which is you need capital. You need machines to allow you to bring back those jobs. Turns out a lot of those machines and the parts associated with them aren't built in the United States. So if you're putting tariffs on the kinds of things that you would need for employers and firms to recapitalize a broader manufacturing effort in the United States, tariffs are not the way to do that. And so essentially, I think all of what Trump would personally, in his mind, think that tariffs are going to do, right, raise money, solve the trade deficit, aid in American reindustrialization, it's going to become pretty clear that that is not happening, right? Because again, it's kind of the fantasy
It's not
version
how
of.
any of this works.
Yeah, it's like the fantasy version of tariffs that I think influences the ways in which he thinks about the appeal of this particular tool in the economic toolkit. So the question is, when he doesn't get what he's looking for, does Trump back down? And, you know, this is a person we've been talking about now for almost 10 years. He does not show a lot of evidence of backing down or admitting that his theory of change might have been incorrect. And so if this is an ideological project, are they going to convince themselves essentially that, you know, we need more time, true tariffs have never been tried, you know, the country's against us, we need to actually see this all through, which is what some of his advisors have said publicly. And then the thing is, if that is what plays out, there is actually a way in which the United States enters this spiral, essentially, where investors are pulling money out of the U.S. I think you already see that with what's happening in bond markets, where treasury yields are going up, suggesting that, you know, normally when people don't feel great about stocks, they look at bonds. That's not what's happening right now, suggesting that people are pulling their U.S. dollars out of the U.S. market altogether and converting it to other currencies to safeguard elsewhere. So if that happens, I mean, we're essentially talking about the United States relinquishing just decades of global economic power and leadership on the basis of this experiment in tariffs that isn't going to really fundamentally accomplish anything that the president wants to do. So that's the bigger picture. And then in Asia, there's a ton of opportunities for all of these countries that we've been talking about to integrate among themselves. And this is something we've been talking about on this podcast for more than 10 years now, right? I mean, going back to the debates over the Trans-Pacific Partnership, what has always been true, despite this kind of domestic political context in the United States, where you've had these debates about manufacturing and free trade and trade deficits since the start of the Trump era, is that the demand signals in Asia are completely the opposite. Every major economy in Asia wants to see greater economic integration and freer trade with fewer tariff barriers, right? India is arguably the most protectionist major economy, and even India is participating in trade agreements like RCEP. And American allies, we've talked about Japan and South Korea, but even Australia, all recognize that the center of gravity in the region is going to continue to be China economically, and that economic integration, while competing geopolitically, is going to be the name of the game for these countries to preserve essentially prosperity and their own ability to pursue their national interests in the way that they see fit. So the U.S. is voluntarily removing itself from that context, as it has done so for a while. But the big question is, you know, am I wrong about this fairly gloomy prognosis? And potentially, is there a way in which, like, let's say, Katie, like, we're having the same conversation in December. It's, you know, the holiday season. Nobody is able to buy their kids nice cheap toys that tend to be made in places like China and Vietnam and elsewhere. And American consumers and American voters start realizing that actually globalization and American economic leadership did have some benefits, even if manufacturing jobs went away, and you get sort of a pendulum swing backwards, right? That, I think, has been the most disturbing thing in Asia, which is that really since Obama and the TPP push, there hasn't been anybody in American politics with any level of national popularity, either Republican or Democrat, that has been willing to stake political capital in making the case for globalization or trade integration. I don't think that's going to pop out of this necessarily, but it is interesting to ask. I mean, if we do head into this broader economic spiral in the United States where GDP shrinks, demand decreases, consumers just have access to fewer things, you know, I think I forget which Trump administration official it was. I think maybe Howard Lutnick, who said that Americans aren't about having, American identity is not about having access to cheap goods. And I think you could make a very compelling case that in many ways, post-Cold War America has gotten very used to having access to all those cheap goods. Anyways, that was very long and ranting. I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that.
Yeah. I mean, I want to go back to Vietnam and China, and we can talk about China. But on this last point that you're making, I do think Americans are about to get a very visceral lesson in what free trade actually brought to this country and what getting rid of it is going to do. They're going to get a lesson that they didn't pay attention to in Economics 101. Back to sort of Vietnam and China, one of the interesting things, right, is one of the conversations in the last couple of years was about friendshoring, right? Like trying to redirect manufacturing out of China, because China was, you know, the big foe, to places like Vietnam and India and, you know, in Southeast Asia more broadly, which is why it was so sort of shocking to then see these countries being punished with these reciprocal tariffs, because arguably part of the relocation of manufacturing and sort of the investment by companies in places like Vietnam was the argument that, well, you know, the United States and China have problems and there's tension there. And so if we want to produce goods in Asia at sort of competitive prices. We can move elsewhere in Asia. Some of the countries that are on that the you know reciprocal tariff list at the highest degree are, you know, Cambodia 49%, Laos 48%, Vietnam 46%. Those are the countries that these businesses relocated to because these were perceived as safer bets. And so that has sort of, you know, really come back to bite them. And then when we look at China, of course, is the one country that these reciprocal tariffs have not been paused for. And right here, I want to say that, again, back to the abuse of the English language, the administration says that the reciprocal tariffs, which aren't reciprocal, have been paused, is also sort of a misnomer. There's still a 10% universal tariff on all goods coming into the United States. And that is significantly higher than the averages. You know, averages were only like 2-3%, 5 in some places. So that's still really significant. And I think American consumers are going to start seeing that. And then we'll see what happens after this sort of 90-day pause period, if those tariffs come back at higher degrees and to what extent. But China has not been excluded from this. Tariffs on China have been increased to 125% and then 145% in some specific categories. But there's also been these exceptions, right, on electronic devices, smartphones. In the reciprocal tariff list of exemptions was things like pharmaceuticals and semiconductors. So it's sort of, it is confusing from an analytical perspective that even if this is what the administration is trying to do, is to bring this stuff, this production back to the United States, they're exempting all of the highest value goods. And all. So the question is, who is being punished by this? And the answer is small American producers is really going to be the answer. I think the only companies in the United States that are going to have, as you mentioned, the capital to set up things like manufacturing of toys are going to be mega corporations. You know, your small American businesses that provide American jobs and would like to produce in the United States and can't financially for very obvious fiscal reasons, those are the ones that are going to go away. And you're going to see sort of mega corporations just benefit more. And I think just a note to listeners, you know, these things are difficult, I think, for those of us with an analytical perspective to really get through because there doesn't seem to be a plan. And even administration officials don't know what the plan is. I think one of the more absurd moments was, I think it was either Howard Lutnick or one other official was literally in a congressional hearing when the tariffs were paused. And a member of Congress was like, you don't even know what the policy is. And this is your policy. I think that really speaks volumes as to how policy is being made in the United States right now. And what that does reputationally for the United States and Asia, I don't think is going to be good. And I don't think that will be a controversial take. But I am curious, you know, when we are like, maybe we will come back in December and talk about this again and see where that is, because I do think a lot of things will have changed in how even U.S. allies in Asia view the United States as a reliable partner or not, and what they do in the interim and what they do otherwise. And then just one point, I talked about Japan. I didn't talk so much about South Korea, but South Korea is just sort of finished its own constitutional crisis, really. And President Yoon is out for good, and they will have elections in the next 2 months. And that, I think, will finally give South Korea maybe somebody who's at least in charge and can kind of negotiate on a similar level. But what the effect of that will be, we'll have to see. I think they're going to get a late start in this conversation, and that might ultimately be to China's benefit.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the last closing thought I'd offer here is that, first of all, like, even if you disagree with tariffs as a policy, there's something to be said for taking months, staffing up a bureaucracy, and coming up with a tariff policy that is based on at least something of a consistent theory, and then pushing that out to the world, and then just not changing it, right? Providing predictability, because nobody that runs a business can operate if they don't know quarter to quarter what the costs of various inputs are going to fluctuate by, right? If it's like some weeks there's a pause, some weeks there's 100% increase on tariffs. I mean, you just cannot plan. And so that just adds all this uncertainty that's now, I think, harming the U.S. market, where employers and firms just aren't willing to take risks, do hiring, even potentially push out new products. The other thing, though, I mean, there is a nugget of, you know, Trump has one belief that I think is actually correct, which is that the whole world intrinsically values the U.S. market, right? Which is the whole reason why these tariffs are this tool that the United States can use to really cause global ripple effects. The problem is that stops being true as the rest of the world decides that the United States is no longer going to be reliable. So it only works at the start, right? Like Trump inherits this economy from Biden, which is intrinsically valuable, one of the strongest major developed economies recovering out of the COVID-19 pandemic, and then decides to use that as a cudgel against the rest of the world. That only works until the rest of the world figures out a different arrangement, which is entirely viable, right? I think this is also just this American exceptionalist belief that the United States will always remain at the center of world affairs, and that is just not going to be true if the tariff policy in particular plays out this way. All right, last thought from you,
yeah,
Katie.
Yeah, just a lot. I think that's a really excellent point. And it's the idea of American exceptionalism for the sake of being exceptional, as opposed to for all of these other reasons that actually made the United States exceptional, whether it was trade policy, whether it was our immigration policy, whether it was, you know, just the way of American approach to business and innovation. The actions of this administration are sort of dismantling that like powerful hammer. And you know, once it falls apart in the United States' hand, I don't know what we'll be left with. And that's not the bleak note I really wanted to end on, but that is, I think, where we are. And I think, you know, it's our responsibility to be honest about our analysis and where we think things are. We'll obviously keep an eye on this.
Yep, absolutely. And yeah, definitely want to hear from listeners. I know a lot of folks are obviously tracking a lot of this. The good news is no tariffs on podcasts. So the podcast is still widely and freely available. And on that note, if you like what you heard, make sure you subscribe so you can keep up with future episodes. And if you've been a subscriber for a while, but you haven't yet left us a review, please do that as well. You can do that anywhere you get your podcasts. And we really do appreciate it. It helps the show out quite a bit. All right, Katie, thanks a lot for chatting, and we'll be back soon with more.